This is Judaism Unbound, episode 76, The Project of Jewish Education. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofus.
And we're here today with David Breifman. He is the Chief Innovation Officer at the Jewish Education Project of New York. David has a PhD in Education and Jewish Studies from NYU, where he focused on Jewish adolescent identity development and experiential Jewish education. He's one of the leading voices in thinking about Jewish education today, and also holds the distinction of having been one of our earliest listeners of Judaism Unbound, and certainly one of our earliest folks writing into us. So, David, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's a great thrill to finally have you on.
And it's great to be here.
So, David, before we get started, we wanted to note that one of our former guests on Judaism Unbound in episode 37, Dr. Jonathan Wucher, passed away recently on July 7th. And you and I both agreed that we wanted to dedicate today's episode of Judaism Unbound to him and to his legacy. And I know that you were much closer to him than I was. He meant a lot to me, but more sort of from a distance. I always felt so grateful to have him out there as a cheerleader for what we were doing. But I was hoping that you could just share a little bit about what you think that he meant to you and to the wider world of Jewish education and to the Jewish community at large.
Well, for me, Jonathan Wucher is really one of the great contributors to American Jewish education over the last few decades, and also to North American Jewry in general. He based a lot of his work in the deep understanding of who Jews were today and what they represented today. And then he wanted to make the real push and the claim that Jewish education needed to constantly become relevant for who those Jews were. Some of the unique contributions of John, I think, were in the realm that he was one person that was able to be within the organized Jewish community, but also really to push that community to change and to continually update and innovate itself, but also to work with the startup Jewish organizations to help them find their place and really to see the nexus between those two groups in the community as a whole. The ability for John to treat both parties, both didn't matter who he was talking to or about, with an honor and respect and a dignity to make them feel like they were part of the conversation, not separate to the conversation, was also one of his major contributions as a human being as well. At his funeral and also in many of the posts that followed, I think the most common quote that was associated with John was the verse from Ethics of Our Fathers, Aselecha Rav, Eknelecha Chaver, to find for yourself a teacher and to acquire for yourself a friend. And I think for so many people, John was both that. He was a colleague, but he also did so in such a way where he became a friend to so many people as well. He would always do so with a smile and an optimism that I think will long be remembered by many. And his contribution to the field of American Jewish education in general and worldwide, I don't think can be stated highly enough. I'll definitely miss him as someone I've worked with on several projects before. I urge you to go back and listen to his episode on the podcast, which was a really deep insight into his caring and commitment for Jewish wisdom and its potential impact as well. Really one of the greats of Jewish education.
Yeah, and as I'm listening to you talk, I'm just thinking to how, you know, again, my experience, he was someone who lived in the New York area, and I'm here in Chicago, and so I didn't cross paths with him all that often. But when I did, you know, there was always this sort of moment of surprise over and over, in the sense that in my mind, here is somebody who is deeply ensconced in the established Jewish world. Here he's running a major organization within the Federation system, and yet I never heard anything from him other than enthusiasm and interest and excitement about some of my more radical ideas, not necessarily that he agreed, but that he thought that it was great that I was thinking that way and trying things out. And to have that person out there who, like you say, sort of belied the claim that is often made that there's some sort of inherent tension between the old world of Judaism and the new world of Judaism, but no, that actually there are people who see that there's really a bridge from one to the other and go on and help create it. And specifically for me, I think what he is the deepest role model for is somebody who fundamentally believed that the importance of ideas, you know, and the importance that we have to find the ideas that are going to make that bridge and the language that we can use to articulate them. And then I think in many ways, then what we're doing here today and this whole podcast is actually part of his legacy in a way that I don't think that I had fully absorbed until this moment. So, David, let's switch gears and get into your own work. Could you share with us first a little bit about what the Jewish Education Project is and What does it mean to be the chief innovation officer there?
So the Jewish Education Project has been around as the Jewish Education Project for only 10 years. And many of your listeners probably know it best as the Board of Jewish Education of New York. But it was about 10 years ago when the organization was given the mandate to reinvent itself, not just rebrand itself with a different name, but establish itself with a new relevant mission. So basically, we're an agency that looks after Jewish education as an umbrella type organization across the greater New York area. Now we have a bit of a national portfolio as well, primarily operating in day schools, synagogues, congregation schools, early childhood centers, and teen engagement programs. So my mandate as the Chief Innovation Officer is basically to reimagine Jewish education today for where the reality of the people are, and to acknowledge that what got us here is not what's going to get us there. And if we're to try and reimagine the whole landscape, what could it begin to look like?
How should one think about the aims of education and how that all fits together?
Jewish education has primarily followed a definition of general education, which is the transmission of knowledge, primarily knowledge, but also skills, from one generation to the next generation. There's an additional part of that sentiment, which is you transmit knowledge and skills from one generation to the next generation in order to perpetuate what the adult generation actually wants from their offspring in order to continue the status quo. And in general terms, that's what education has often been about. And I'd suggest quite strongly that Jewish education in the main has been exactly that, that we've been teaching our children, and education is not always just about children, but predominantly our children, how to be Jews just like us. And the problem there is that the starting point is no longer the same starting point, and the end point is no longer the same end point. So what I like to try and suggest in some rough terms is that Jewish education has traditionally been about how do we make people more Jewish, or how do we make Jewish institutions stronger, or how do we make the Jewish community stronger? And no matter which angle you take, the person becoming more Jewish, the community or the institution, the point of your focus is actually not the learner. The point of focus is actually the Jewish or the community or the institution. And the fundamental shift that I'm suggesting that needs to take place is not by asking that question, but by asking the different question is, how can being Jewish help you to be more successful or to thrive or to flourish, whatever language you want to use there, in the world in which we live? My thinking there is also largely influenced by where people are today, not just millennials, but teenagers as well, and probably older people, is that they're very much in everything for the individual value which they get from it. But I don't want people to think that what I'm talking about here is an acquiescence to the narcissism of today's millennials. What I'm suggesting here is that all education should always have been about making something relevant and meaningful. And now we're at a turning point where we really need to ask the question of what value and what meaning does Judaism have to the people that we're talking about?
So whenever narcissistic millennials are mentioned, I like to see if Lex wants to jump in with a question.
Yeah, I've been told it's an offensive term.
I understand what you're getting at. I know that this isn't that you weren't making a point that, you know, my generation is a bunch of selfish folks. But I'd love to confront a big elephant in the Jewish education room, as I perceive it, which is the most common form of Jewish education in terms of the most humans that are engaging in it is Sunday school education. And often what we see there is that it seems either implicitly or sometimes explicitly that the end goal, it's not even the strengthening of the community. I mean, it's certainly not the focus on relevance to the individual, but I would argue it's not even always the community. It's often to create a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah or a bi mitzvah, to use Amichael Alevi's gender neutral term that incorporates trans and genderqueer folks. And I guess I'd love to hear from you sort of how that creates obstacles to the kinds of educational goals that you are laying out that would be better.
So it's a really complicated question because it involves so many of the things that you guys have been speaking about for so long now. To talk about the bar mitzvah as the end game, the bat mitzvah as the end game, is entwined with so many other questions, largely to do with congregation membership and affiliation. If that's the end game and that's why people are trying to perpetuate, then that's a really different conversation about what are the outcomes of Jewish education. There are very few children today where I could actually say that the skill that they need to be a 21st century Jew is the capacity to lane Torah and say a few blessings. And for those that is the meaningful transition, like I'm really thrilled and I'm really excited that that's what they should be able to do. To then put 6 years or 4 years of mandatory Hebrew school behind that in order to get to that stage is a whole question of like, well, that's just a waste of time and resources for everyone. But Hebrew school, Sunday school, congregational school, supplemental school, no matter what you call it, suffers from quite a few unfortunate set of circumstances. The number one being that most parents who did not enjoy it perpetuate those myths. And let me just say just a couple of things, because it's an area that I'm increasingly doing more work in. When we talk to the parents of most young children, and here I'm saying below third and fourth grade, they're actually pretty happy going to Hebrew school if it's done well. If it's got cultural and social and even learning elements in a fun environment with good, dynamic, young, often, but spirited educators, those kids actually enjoy it. And rightly so, because young people like exploring new things and they're generally curious. And the good part about the Jewish question today is that most Jews are really proud about their heritage. So a place where they can learn things and then bring it back to their families and display positive Jewish habits, people are really excited about that. The problem arises when kids get to fifth, sixth, seventh grade and all of a sudden they have all of these competing extracurricular activities in their life. And now we're no longer playing apples and apples. We're asking an unfair scenario. What would you like to do as a 12-year-old? Would you like on your Sunday morning to go and play soccer with your friends? Or would you like to go back into a classroom environment where you were as a fourth grade kid? And here it's an unfair comparison. We have to change our mindset here. And the mindset has to move. And some people have said, we have to move from a language of surviving to thriving. And for me, that's really critical, is that I don't need to be able to teach a kid just how to daven a certain nusach in a certain, to pray in a certain tradition in a certain congregation. I need them to be empowered to be able to carry on their spiritual journey no matter where they go and where they take that in their lives. But my outcome from starting point is not to create a whole lot of literate or wise people in core Jewish text. My real mission here is to make sure that Jewish wisdom speaks to these kids in their lives and makes it meaningful to be able to take them to the next level of their life, of whatever that might be. So for me, that's the fundamental starting point. If you cannot get out of the mindset that Jewish education is about telling kids what they ought to know in order to be good Jews, anything else I'm about to say is virtually irrelevant. And I'd like to say that everybody is on board with that, but it's still not the case. There are many places of Jewish education where they firmly believe that they must tell the kids what they need to know. And I'll make an argument that it's not an exact translation, but I think it's good enough for this conversation in some ways, is that I don't think Torah Lishma, learning Torah for the sake of learning Torah, has much inherent value for the population we're talking about today. They will be too quick to ask the question of why I should be learning it, of why this is relevant, and how this is going to make an impact on my life. That doesn't mean I'm against the study of Torah. In fact, the opposite. And I think you actually need to be a more learned educator to do what I'm about to suggest, which is actually know where to take the kids' questions and to supply them with textual or Jewish wisdom answers to help them grapple with those questions is actually more complicated a task.
I want to talk about a few terms that I hear all the time in Jewish education circles, but also in the Jewish world more broadly, and their education, which I think is clear. And there's advocacy, which I've actually seen in many cases consciously blended. Like people will tell you that they're not only in Jewish educational settings looking to educate, they're also looking to create certain kinds of advocates. And I've grown increasingly uncomfortable with the fusion that occurs between education and advocacy. And people talk about it in the realm of Israel, but it's not just Israel. It's all sorts of issues where what we're doing is we're teaching. In a sense, it's teaching. We're teaching people to feel a certain way about whether it's Judaism or Israel or Kashrut or Shabbat or whatever. And we're not focused as much on what I see as the great strength of education, which is putting out some ideas and knowledge, competing ideas, and creating a situation where students can come to that conclusion. And I understand why in a religious context, there's always going to be some level of that emotion that comes into play. But to me, I think of the analogy of if we were teaching somebody to play soccer, we would teach them the skills of playing soccer. We would teach them, you know, inside, outside, foot techniques. We teach them shooting, passing, dribbling. If we want them to be a soccer fan, we give them a flag and we have them learn some chants and we have them sort of situate themselves around other fans where they can learn. And I think often what we're doing is we're sort of creating a set of fans of Judaism, like people who are proud to be Jewish. That's the big buzzword that people talk about. We want our children to be proud of being Jewish. And we might not be doing as good a job at creating people who are educated about stuff within the realm of Judaism.
So there are almost like so many ways to respond to that question before even responding to that question. So the first thing I'd say is that let's not kid ourselves. All education is ideological. And every decision an educator makes, no matter what the context, is filled with their own personal philosophy and ideological guidelines, presuming they've got some sort of autonomy in the space they're working with. But every time I choose to include a text or not include a text or quote someone or show one film clip, I am making choices all along which are inherently based in my own ideological background. And I think it's about time we acknowledge that. And I think the love of the Jewish people is an inherent value which I want the kids who I interact with and the educators to impart. And I've got no problem saying that. As difficult as it is to teach love or connectedness to the Jewish people, I think that those are values which I'm not prepared to negotiate. And whatever I need to do to give them that sense of belonging and feeling and commitment, I'm in that for the long haul, and I think it's really important. And I don't think what you've described as being a fan is necessarily always right, but I do think that we infantilize Jewish education to a point where it's not meaningful for every developmental stage, which might in turn end up with them becoming so-called fans. Our inability to be able to teach Pesach differently every year according to the developmental scope and sequence of where that kid is at, that's on us as educators, and I think that's in play with all the things you just said. But I do make the distinction between advocacy and indoctrination. Indoctrination has no place in Jewish education as far as I'm concerned, although clearly in some settings it might be what's operating there. And all that being said, you then just raise the big, the heresy conversation in all of this, and that's what happens when you start talking about Israel. And as some people have said, it's like, almost like the last heresy of Jewish world and Jewish education today. Like, I can get up here and say, oh, I don't believe in God, or I do believe in God. No one's really going to care. They might, but like, it's not going to, the earth is not going to, well, it might, but not for me, the earth is not going to fall apart. But if I start talking in certain language about Israel, then I've gone off some sort of third rail in the Jewish world. And just to say that I'm very clear, there is a very, very important distinction between Israel education and Israel engagement and Israel advocacy. And I have a lot of respect for the work that people do in the realm of Israel advocacy. I think it's extremely, extremely important, as I do for the people involved in the branding of Israel and marketing. If that's what their profession and that's what their work is, that's very important. But that's not Israel education. Jewish education is not black and white, and I don't give simple answers about anything. And in today's world, everything is complex. And in a postmodern world, everything involves multiple perspectives and multivocality. So I think we can learn a lot about the distinction between Israel advocacy and education that reflects on Jewish education. But I wouldn't like that to contaminate all of our discussions. I would say, though, just because we've raised the topic of Israel and Israel education, the divide between the institutions that fund Israel education and Israel advocacy on a generational level is increasingly so distant from where the majority of our young people are today that it's emblematic of many of the issues that you've been talking about in this wonderful podcast. For me, when people talk about there's an impending gap, there's a possible gap, in terms of Israel, that ship has sailed. The gap is so large between where so many of our funders and foundations and federations think finances should be invested in terms of Israel education our people are completely on a different political and social and values-laden track, that there's a gap there, which I am fearful that we cannot bridge.
I think it's an interesting, another interesting case is, that I remember, I'll give my dad a little bit of a shout out here. His undergraduate thesis topic always spoke to me, which is that he studied the students who were involved in the Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, in the 60s. And what he found, which was interesting, was that they were perceived by society to be rebelling against their parents. And yet when he interviewed them, for the most part, they understood themselves to be actually carrying on the legacy of their parents, but in a more extreme way than their parents might have been comfortable with. And sometimes I wonder whether we're seeing sort of a very similar thing today in terms of Israel, in that so many of the young activists, if you talk to them, they actually understand themselves to be playing out values that they feel that they learned through Jewish education. And it's actually interesting that the community doesn't look at that as a great success of Jewish education, that these folks have actually are the ones who have really internalized some of these values and are applying them, whether you agree with the way that they're applying them or not, to Israel, and instead sort of looks at it as a sort of subversive sort of enemy force that has to be combated. I mean, I think that's an issue in its own right, but it also, I think, raises this question of what successful education looks like. And I guess to me, it's partly the conflict between, like you described earlier, the idea of education as something put into place by the older generation to sort of perpetuate the status quo among the young versus something that the older generation provides to the young in order to empower them to take it where they need to take it for their own next generation.
Nothing will trump the values of universalism, diversity, and equality for this generation. Nothing at all. Not religion, not even love. They won't even marry someone or look to someone who doesn't have that set of those similar values. So it's no wonder for me that those kids today and that generation are applying those attitudes towards not only Israel, but to all of their Jewish experience as well, which for many of them seem very particularistic and parochial. When you ask young people today, who are the historical heroes and figures when it comes to issues of oppression in the world today, and they talk to you about Martin Luther King Jr. and Gandhi, and those who know a bit more Jewishly talk to you about Heschel, who are all very strong advocates of nonviolent forms of resistance in the face of oppression. So now you have these social progressives attaching their heroes to this whole situation. And I'm not surprised that so many young Jews are coming out in favor of perceived anti-Israel action, which many could argue is actually pro-Israel action as well. But it's a complete disconnect to where their parents are. But it's interesting, if you apply that same sort of narrative to Jewish education in general, I think you're right, Dan, that there's a similar narrative which appears here. If you give kids a certain tools to perpetuate their parents' or their grandparents' institutions, they're going to reject that for a whole lot of reasons. If you give them tools which empower them to go off and build their own meaningful spiritual communities, they should be seen as our greatest success stories and not the villains of the Jewish world. All that being said, let's not diminish what we're really talking about here. When you get to the stage where you've got younger generation rejecting the values of the older generation in any society, what you're talking about is classic disruptive innovation, as you've spoken about so many times. And by definition, if disruptive innovation is successful, those people that control the status quo are not going to be happy because there's a sense of loss. And the reason they like the status quo is because they have the power. And as soon as that is challenged, they don't like it. So none of this is surprising. It's just interesting because we're now seeing it play itself out on scale before our very eyes. This goes back, Lex, to answering your initial question, which I repeat again, that all education has an ideological agenda behind it. Whether you call it advocacy or not is a different question. It does raise the question, which is a good one for one of you to ask in some ways, is who creates that agenda? And I would argue that largely today, it's not actually created by educators. There are forces at play in the Jewish community beyond the educators that are actually creating the educational agenda that we're now finding ourselves in.
I think what I hear you describing, at least to some extent, and I think what certainly seems true and likely, is that there are agendas that shape and that have shaped the forms of education that are available to most Jews. Those agendas could range from being the agenda of a funder who might be infusing a lot of money into the field and therefore has a great deal of sway. And they could also be the agendas of synagogues, for example, which I think quite clearly have used the bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah, bi mitzvah, although actually probably more historically, the bar mitzvah, as a way to maintain membership by saying that you can only have a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah if you go, you know, enroll in the religious school for X number of years, and you can only enroll in the religious school if you're a member of the synagogue, etc. And so not that they've done it for nefarious reasons, but that there is an economic model tied to it, which is not based on education being the driving goal, but rather something else. And so there are all these agendas that have sort of resulted in the field of offerings that we have for education. Now, one potential way, so then essentially the question becomes, what are parents to do who say, look, I don't really like the sort of educational options that are available. I don't really want to have the Judaism that those educational options are built towards. And yet, I don't know what's, there's nothing else available, or I don't know about anything else that's available. And so the question, in a sense, is, are there things that are available? Are there things that might become available? Is this a place where maybe the internet can play an important role? How are there ways that maybe collectives of parents have done things? Like, what is the way to sort of disruptively break through this, knowing that there actually is probably a substantial market of parents who would seek this alternative educational option if it were available to them?
Demographics and sociology are important here. Most Jews in America today live in certain areas where there are other sizable Jewish populations. And that's largely nothing to do with the fact that they're Jewish, but based on socioeconomic issues and, frankly, the education where they're going to send their children of this age, there are major centers where Jewish populations live, many of them which have large Jewish educational offerings in those particular cities and urban environments. And I would argue that actually most people know about them. And it's not a matter of just having more marketing to tell people about them, but they're actively choosing to drive past it or to drive into it because they know it's there. They might choose that they want it or they don't. And I'm really, you know, big on this, is that unless we can articulate the value of how Jewish education is going to make a difference in someone's life, then I think we'll go out of business. And I think the Jewish, that's where I think Rabbi Erwin Kula is spot on here. If we can't articulate those values for the Jewish, for Judaism, and then for me, Jewish education, then I think the enterprise will go out of business. I think those Hebrew schools will close down. Those camps will become irrelevant, whatever it might be. So that value proposition is really important. And then the question becomes, how can we make it affordable and accessible to many, many more people? And here it's an important part of the overall discussions you have been having, because the Jewish education enterprise has been heavily influenced by the changes in Jewish philanthropy and fundraising in the last few decades. I am fortunate enough to belong to an organization, to work for an organization that is supported all the way by a Jewish Federation of New York. And I would say, you know, without hesitation, this is one federation which really gets the fact that legacy institutions have a place to really make a difference, and simultaneously help startup organizations actually make their mark on the world as well. And unfortunately, not all federations have the ability to be able to do so, or they don't prioritize it as such. And what's happened in the last few decades is that mainly family foundations have taken this role, and in doing so, are determining many of the new offerings in Jewish education. And the good news about family foundations is that there are many of them, and they are wealthy and they can make a difference. The bad news, by their own admission, is that they're not accountable to anyone other than themselves. And as someone has wisely said, if you know one foundation, you know one foundation. The Jewish foundation world and their influence on Jewish education and identity is huge. I'll give you one example. Now, you cannot find many places that don't include the word Jewish education in the same sentence as Jewish education and engagement. Engagement is not the same thing as education. They are qualitatively and philosophically and pedagogically just very, very different things. And the foundation world has largely equated the two as being the same enterprise. to their credit, more and more dollars are going into Jewish education than ever before. But it has a whole lot of pitfalls as well.
I'd love to ask a question that relates back to something you alluded to before. And I want to talk about adults, because when I hear, if I'm being honest, when I hear education, and when I think most people hear education, our mind shoots directly to childhood, which makes sense. That's where lots of us were shaped educationally. But what I've noticed among deeply Jewishly engaged people I know, a huge percentage of them will tell you straightforwardly they had none or very poor Jewish education growing up. And it was only in college or later that through some, whether it was an accident or a conscious decision, they grew deeply connected, first probably connected to Judaism or cared about Judaism, and then educated about elements of Judaism. And I'd love to just hear from you about that, because I think we have this mindset in our mind, and maybe this is part of what's behind all of the money that goes into Jewish education. We have a mindset that suggests, you know, if we, and there is some truth to this, if we don't reach people in the first, I don't know, X years of their life, their first 13 years or maybe their first 18 years of life, they're just not going to seek out Judaism or connect to it. And I think part of this is the internet, and that people have the ability to look easier for Judaism than they did in the past. So maybe that's part of the change. But do you think, like, to what extent is that really the way it is? And do we really need to focus directly on childhood education? And to what extent might we actually really benefit from deepening and broadening the kinds of adult education that we're experimenting with in the world?
I would say that the adolescent years should not be underestimated in any stretch here. And if you are able to influence someone in those critical years when they're actually becoming, you know, largely who they're going to be in their lives, there is a certain amount which everything after that is going to be somewhat remedial. So I don't want to underestimate the importance of those adolescent years. And anyone now who knows adolescence knows that it's not just talking about age 13 to 17, but emerging adolescence extends to some say 26, but even older. But they are the critical years. The other piece which is important is there is a thought in Jewish education that it's always has been about preparing people for the next stage in life. Like, the purpose of early childhood education, the best possible outcome, is that they'll all enroll in a Jewish early childhood program, then go on to Hebrew school. And the best involvement for Hebrew school is, well, they can go on to a teen program. And as a teen program, the best case scenario is they'll find a Hillel or a Chabad on campus. And the problem is that everyone sort of kicks the bucket of outcomes to the next demographic. And then you get to a certain point in life when you graduate from college and there's nothing out there for you. And that's a huge gap. And it's not just a huge gap for the Jewish people, but it's a huge gap for anyone involved in values-based or civics-based education, because basically there are other priorities at that stage of somebody's life. However, for committed Jews, and there aren't enough of these options available, when there are good offerings for those demographics, we are seeing more and more young Jewish adults gravitating to those options, so that should not be underestimated. I think we often believe that providing a young experience of something, so calling something the young division of whatever organization, that will attract them. And I find that very patronizing in so many ways. And then as part of your equation there, I also don't think we should be neglecting what happens to families and adults once those kids have left home. And the so-called boomer generation, well, I actually think that's the biggest opportunity in terms of growth in Jewish education that's available now. It's virtually a blank landscape. Those people now have time on their hands and they've got income in many cases, and they want to spend it doing something valuable. And I think that is a huge opening in the Jewish education sector. You did raise the issue of digital, and this should not be underestimated, because I think it's important. I was once interviewing someone for a position helping us to develop a website and content on our website for our agency. And she turned around to me very astutely and she said, if you want to influence the most number of Jews with Jewish education, don't employ me here. Like, you should be putting a whole lot of people to go and work, you know, for Wikipedia, not work for them, but like updating Wikipedia sites, or you know, working on search optimizations for Google, because the vast majority of Jews are engaged in Jewish learning, not Jewish education, but at least Jewish learning through the internet and various forms of social media. And that shouldn't be downplayed. If you now do Google searches for most Jewish terms, you will find the same websites coming up most of the time, which may or may not speak to what type of Jew that you are, but it's clear that there are not many highly optimized Jewish sites for non-Orthodox, progressively leaning, universalist Jews that are coming to the fore of their web searches. So that is a huge sector of investment as well, because they're not going to their rabbis for their Jewish questions, and they're going to Google or Wikipedia if it's a research project.
Yeah, and so I want to follow up on that in a certain way, which is I've been thinking recently, and I'm curious, like, how you think about this as an educator. I've been thinking a lot about whether Heschel's having marched with Martin Luther King in Selma was the single most effective, I'm not talking about whether you agree or not, but the single most effective moment of Jewish education in 20th century history, let's say. Meaning that a lot of Jews, I think, sort of fundamentally have picked up an understanding of what Judaism is all about by sort of translating that moment for them in terms of their understandings. And that makes me wonder, in one sense, it makes me wonder sort of what's all the value of all the many, many hours spent in educational contexts, much of which is forgotten and not valuable. And actually, this one moment was so powerful. And on the sort of flip side of that, you know, I go to the digital realm also, and, you know, and I ask, is it possible that when we think about, you know, you talked earlier that it's hard to scale educational innovations that happen outside of institutions, and that may be right to the extent that we're talking about educational institutions that look similar to other educational institutions. But if we think about something like BimBam, which is an educational venture that is online, and scale just means bringing more eyeballs to it, right? It doesn't have to open up new centers, or what we're doing, or, you know, what we might do in the future, or other things. And so I guess, like, the sort of where I'm going with this question sort of in combination is, you know, are there ways in which we might think differently about the educational endeavor overall, so that, you know, another thing that I meant to raise was this question of, yes, I totally agree that education and engagement are different. But when we think about the way that people are educated in things that they really love, like sports, for example, it's often through the engagement, right? That there's nobody who sits and teaches them lectures about how baseball works. It's just they play baseball. Now, a lot of people want to say, well, Jews should go to synagogue more, etc. But I think that the fundamental premise here is that, no, Judaism is changing. So there's something. So going to synagogue would be a miseducation, because it wouldn't be education towards something that they're actually going to do in the future. But that somehow there is an element where saying some kind of engagement, maybe in what we hope they might do, like Jewish public service or Jewish environmental stuff or whatever, is actually both a way to educate them a la Heschel, and that the sort of knowledge education, the information, will be picked up through new approaches like online that are actually, on the scale of things per user, right, quite cheap.
Your point about Heschel is fascinating, and I agree that it might have become one of the most important historical events as reference points. The problem with it is that it's become reduced in so many ways to what you've called many times before, just the tikkun olam phenomenon, the desire to save the world. And I think in some ways it's lost its inherent meaning, and it's lost its bravery and its courage. It's now seen as like an act, the equivalent of, recycling your trash sort of thing. It's like, any little action that you do now falls into the same category as Heschel walking at Selma. And I think, that's never what tikkun olam as a precept was designed to be about. So there's a problem there, but that's just in general. The pediatric nature of the way that we reduce Judaism to its core things, I think, is a fundamental flaw, and that's one example where it plays itself out. I had an interesting Facebook experiment a few months ago. I was trying to ask the question of, what were some of the most influential popular culture moments of Jews in America that had real influence? And I was stirred by a couple of things, and this is a bit of background about myself, is that I actually thought that Rabbi Michael Lerner's eulogy at the Muhammad Ali funeral was a point in time when that was a really, really interesting Jewish moment in America for so many reasons. And it never resonated, perhaps because Rabbi Lerner's message went a bit too radical for some. But the fact that a Jew of such prominence was able to give such a message there, and I do look a lot to popular culture. And that's largely because I think that's where our young people are turning today for their role models. And I look at the type of Jew that Sarah Silverman or John Stewart or Drake is portraying and putting out there. And in many ways, these are totally emblematic of the young Jews today. They're universalists, they're cynical, they're funny, they're questioning, they're doing all of those things, and they're clearly not religious in traditional sense of the word. And for me, that is Jewish ethnicity and Jewish culture at play today. So, I mean, I don't want to say that Heschel at Selma is being replaced by John Stewart, although if you look at the results of the last Pew survey, where so many Jews affiliated towards humor, I'm not sure that's not more resonant for where our people are today.
Yeah, but my point is about Heschel is less about sort of what happened next, but just that education happened there. And I think that often people don't see that as a moment of education. Now, and you might say it's miseducation. Same thing with Sarah Silverman, John Stewart, Drake, right? That you might not like the education that's coming out of it, but it's a powerful education, right? And it is actually functioning as education. And as opposed to our more formal educational contexts, which are actually not functioning as education because they're not actually having an effect. So in a sense, my question is, how might we learn from one and apply it to the other?
So just let me layer that with a bit of educational theory, which is, I think, really important here, which is that we all have experiences in life where we learn something. And you go through your daily experience learning when to cross the street, when not to cross the street, when to put your hand near the stove, when not to put the stove, whatever it is, watching the news, not watching the news. And we all learn all the time in our lives. And that's just a fundamental aspect of what it means to be a human being in the world today. Education is not the same thing. Education is an environment which may or may not utilize those learning experiences, but definitely involves an element at least of reflecting upon those experiences to make meaning of them for yourself so they can actually transform who you are. And that element of reflection usually only takes place in an organized setting where you have a facilitator who mediates that environment for you. So yes, many people may experience and learn something, but for it to become really educative, I do believe that element of reflection and then sequence and construction is important for it to be classified as education. But if only we took advantage more of those prominent learning experiences, wouldn't Jewish education become more and more meaningful? I think that's a really important point to make. If more and more educators were attuned to looking out for those symbols and those experiences, wouldn't we be better off? That's for sure. But it is different to going about life learning in those circumstances.
Can you say a little bit more about what you said earlier in terms of legacy institutions or institutions that already have scale, and that actually being probably, in your view, the most effective way to bring about these kinds of changes? And the question is, how do you foresee that happening? You know, I know that you're very engaged in the type of ideas and content that we're talking about here in this show, and that you also are working within the larger field of existing institutions to sort of bring about change. And I'm wondering if you could share with us kind of the way in which you think that change can be brought about. Like, what needs to happen very practically?
Really practically? So, I will go almost to any place to, my background was in adolescent identity development. I'll go to almost any congregation, any JCC once to talk to them about Jewish teen engagement. I won't turn up again unless they have a teenager or a young adult on their board or on their decision-making, whatever it is, on their curriculum committee, but as a real voice at the table. Like, we train our kids in our youth groups in all of this stuff to be able to have a voice, and they should be given that voice. So, really practically, like, let's listen to them from really on the ground to make sure that they've got a voice. The second thing I'd say, my first one might have been a bit, it's not just window dressing, but it might seem symbolic. The second one is really philosophical. Like, I walk into a Jewish organization as a 30-something. I'm now a 40-something. But if I walked in there as a 30-something, and I'd say, I really, really want to get involved. And they'd say, that's great. The young adult division is around the corner, or next gen, or the future of the Jewish people rests with you. All those words are patronizing and condescending. If I was a 30-something, who in every other sector in my life is able to make a real difference in this world, and I do and I can, then why would I accept being called young or the next gen by some organization that my parents or grandparents involved with? So all of those labels have to go, and because young people now deserve that seat around the table and stop being shoved into the corner. And that's a really practical thing. I'll tell any federation this. Like, the only reason you have next gen in your lexicon is because adults are scared they're going to lose their seat around the table. But those young people, they deserve that seat. And the reason I say that all is because the world has just changed. And my third, like, practical thing for you just to put here is that people often don't understand how the world has actually really changed. And research actually does speak to people. And the Jewish community as a whole needs to reinvest in serious, as independently as it possibly can, research to understand the phenomenon that we're going through and the transformation that we're going through. And I know you've played around with terminology here before, but I do fundamentally believe that the time period we're going through right now as North American Jews is a revolutionary time, and then we're going to come out on the other side of it looking nothing like we did even just a few years ago. There are so many elements now which can predict where that future is going to go that we're just ignoring because they're threatening to us. So I would say the third element is actually researching these trends and not saying to ourselves, those young people are just going to grow out of it, because I don't think they are.
Thank you so much, David Reifman, for coming on and having such a wonderful conversation with us. We really enjoyed it.
Absolute pleasure to be here and to contribute to what I think is a really awesome enterprise, and the impact that you're having, I think, is being felt by many people beyond these recordings. So thank you for all the work that you do as well.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Judaism Unbound featuring David Reifman, and we want to close it out in the same way that we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can check out our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can hit us up via email at dan@nextjewishfuture.org or lex@nextjewishfuture.org. The last plug we like to make is that you can always support us financially with a one-time gift or a monthly recurring donation, and you can do that at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening, and with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.